From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Joy Powers. Today we'll hear from Anodyne workers who are trying to unionize after the local coffee company was sold.
If they just start to replace us with people that they hired that they can give the Fairway version of Anodyne to, then they won't have someone questioning every move it is that they make.
In Capital Notes, we'll look at what's happening with immigration policy in Wisconsin. Plus, we'll learn about the Milwaukee Philatelic Society, one of the oldest stamp clubs in the country.
You can collect these very artistic little pieces of paper, getting it off the mail if you actually get mail coming in. You naturally want to learn what the stamp is about.
All of that is coming up on Lake Effect. But first, here are today's headlines. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Joy Powers, and thank you so much for joining us. On Wednesday, workers at Anodyne will vote on forming a union. Founded in 1999, the Milwaukee-based coffee chain has earned a reputation for stellar coffee and hospitality, attracting dedicated customers who claim its four locations as their go-to local coffee shop. But the story of its unionization efforts uncovers a nationwide coffee conglomerate, a private equity portfolio that includes roofing services and sports camps, and a barrage of firings that drove its workers to band together. Lake Effect's Sam Woods has this story.
Sid Vineyard is one of those types of people who's interested in everything. No topic too obscure, no skill unrefined, and no venture taken half-heartedly.
My running joke is I am a barista with an English degree. I graduated in May of 2024 with an English degree with a focus in creative writing and poetry and a certificate of Celtic studies. So yes, I can speak Irish. That is a language. It's not just an accent. but I had applied for grad school, got rejected, and I had been working at Anodyne, and I just decided to kind of take life as it came. And I was like, if baristing is what I'm going to be doing, then I'll put all of myself into that.
Vineyard is a coffee lead at Anodyne Coffee Roasting Company, a small chain of coffee shops in Milwaukee. They love baristaing, in part because helping customers learn about the drinks they order matches their experience as a tutor in college.
Baristas, though we look tired and brooding most of the time, we're all pretty fun people to be around, so yeah.
But Vineyard would soon be taking on an unpaid second job organizing their workplace, helping to get 100% of Anodyne employees to sign union cards, and in the process, taking on a multi-dimensional corporate structure that includes a Kansas City-based nationwide coffee conglomerate and the private equity behind it. Anodyne was founded in 1999 by Matt McClutchie and Lacey Perry. Over the next 24 years, the two built the company out to a local institution, offering coffee, pizza, and live events across four locations. But in 2023, the two were ready to seek a new chapter and sold the company to Fairwave Specialty Coffee Collective, a coffee conglomerate based in Kansas City, Missouri. Fairwave manages 11 brands across the United States, and Anodyne is its only Milwaukee-based brand, but the other brands can be found in places like Minneapolis, Kansas City, and Baltimore. Fairwave itself is owned by Great Range Capital, a private equity firm also based in the Kansas City area. Its active portfolio includes companies in the coffee industry like Fairwave, but also sports camps, beauty supplies, and IT disposal services. Dr. John Haywood is a professor and director of the graduate program in Human Resources and Labor Relations at UW-Milwaukee. He explains why a private equity firm might have such a diverse range of assets.
Private equity is really an investment strategy. It's an investment strategy that involves really buying and managing either private companies or taking a public company, that is one that has shareholders, buying them all out and taking it private. So basically, the private equity firm owns the firm that, you know, it's purchased it in its entirety. And it does so primarily with the idea that what it's going to do is to reduce costs, increase revenue, make profit higher, and then sell it at a substantial markup from what they bought it from. So private equity is really the process of buying and selling firms. And so it creates an enormous incentive to find those cost savings or to find the increased way to make revenue so that this product that they're going to sell, which is the firm they originally bought, is worth more.
I reached out to Fairwave to clarify its relationship with Great Range Capital. While I received information about Fairwave itself from a spokesperson, this relationship was not clarified. But a few months after the sale in 2023, things at Anodyne began to change. Nat Otto, the coffee lead at Anodyne's Wauwatosa location, said customers began to notice changes when Anodyne's popular blend of cold brew was replaced by Fairwave's product.
We started getting our cold brew from Kansas City in like a bag and box, like a 5-gallon boxed wine, basically. And immediately, customers took notice to how different it was. It wasn't as full, like, body and flavor anymore. It tasted watered down.
Next to go was Anodyne's Pizza, sold out of its Bayview location. Otto notes, though, that from a portfolio management perspective, this change was not much of a shock.
Pizza was never really a super profitable thing. It was more a passion project from Lacey. A testament to that is the fact that Lacey and members of the pizza staff at that time would take yearly trips to Italy to see what was happening over there in, like, the independent pizza scene.
Still, customers noticed, and these customers had ideas about what could be done.
That was something that a lot of people noticed, and customers, like, at that time kind of mentioned that we should unionize just on a whim.
But what customers didn't see was a significant dock in starting pay for baristas handed down from Kansas City, a string of firings behind the scenes, and the word unionization was already in the air behind Anodyne counters. Immediately after the sale, Sid Vineyard said Fairwave wanted to dock starting pay by 20%. After some pushback, they'd get their wish.
They wanted to dock starting pay immediately. Matt and Lacey said no. Fairwave pushed back, and to my knowledge, it was a timeline with an expiration of about what seems like a year, because that year has come and gone, and the starting wage for baristas is now $12 an hour, when it used to be you were hired at 14. Once you got bar trained, you were making 15 an hour plus tips. So in a way, Fairwave got what they wanted, just not quite immediately.
And then came the firings, starting with a manager at the Bayview location.
But she, out of the blue, on, it was like a Tuesday night, I guess, people from Fairwave were in town. It was her and another barista closing. That barista got told to leave, and they fired her that night. And we never really got a clear answer as to why. But speculation started to grow after another manager was fired and let go several months later. And then another manager that we had at the market location, when they had a manager meeting after that had happened, there were some things said in that room. Actually, some of those things that were said in that room were about wages and things like that, and he walked out.
The manager walked out.
The manager of the public market location walked out after the manager at Bruce Street was fired, and Fairwave already had a replacement. We were like, you fired her and you already have a replacement? Like, where was the job posting? There was no internal job posting before making it public. You had to have been planning this. You knew. And it at least got me thinking. I was just like, if they just start to replace us with people that they hired that they can give the Fairwave version of Anodyne to, then they won't have someone questioning every move it is that they make. It'll be easier for them. And I didn't like that.
And when manager after manager was fired or walked out over disagreements with Fairwave, whether over cafe operations, sourcing of cold brew, or wage decreases, Vineyard said there was a palpable feeling that anyone could be next. It was either try and fight back collectively now or get picked off one by one.
Tensions were high. There wasn't a good feeling in the air. Things were tense because it really kind of felt like, oh, we're not safe. they don't care about us, but we care about each other and we still care about our customers. So what's there to do? And I was talking with a coworker one day after work, and I was just like, what if we formed a union? What if we did this? And they were like, yeah, I 100%, like, you're not the only one to be thinking like this.
Vineyard and their coworkers had to move quickly and quietly. They contacted a representative from the Milwaukee Area Service and Hospitality Workers Union, or MASH, which also represents workers in the Deer District. MASH, Vineyard, Otto, and other Anodyne workers met secretly over several months, bringing a few more workers on board with each meeting. And on April 14th, Anodyne workers went public, demanding that Fairwave recognize their union voluntarily, as 94% of workers had signed union authorization cards. These cards are a document signed by an individual worker authorizing the union to bargain on their behalf. Days after going public, 100% of workers had signed union cards. Vineyard said Fairwave learned of this effort at the same time the public did.
They had no idea, but we came forward with the 94%, which then, you know, a week later soon turned into 100%. Because quite frankly, it felt like we needed to do something before it was too late, because in that week we demanded recognition. Two more long-term employees of Anodyne were fired, and I was at Bruce Street that day that it happened.
Fairwave declined to voluntarily recognize the union. I asked Fairwave for an interview to give its side of the story and explain why it did not recognize the union after 100% of workers signed authorization cards. A spokesperson declined the interview, saying, quote, "We believe the most fair and inclusive way to determine our path forward is a secret ballot election, ensuring that every team member's voice is heard privately. The election will take place in a few weeks, and we will respect and support the outcome of this democratic process." End quote. The secret ballot election Fairwave refers to is a National Labor Relations Board, or NLRB, election. UW-Milwaukee professor Dr. John Hayward explains what the NLRB is and what it does.
This board was set up as part of the National Labor Relations Act, sometimes called the Wagner Act, that was passed in 1935. And what the Wagner Act provides for is really the protection of employees' rights to organize and bargain collectively. It also involves provisions that employees and the firm must bargain in good faith. And as part of making sure this process works, the process of becoming a union, the board is really the policeman, if you will, or it's the organization that overlooks the process to make sure things are essentially happening according to the law.
When Fairwave says it wants to respect the democratic process, it is referring to this period of deliberation in between when workers sign union authorization cards and when the NLRB election date is set. The idea is that Fairwave will be able to make its case as to why workers would be better off without a union, and workers can independently decide whether they want union representation or not. Haywood explains how this period of deliberation often plays out, including another case involving a coffee chain in Milwaukee.
And so then a process begins, and typically there's a lot of debate, and both sides try to influence the workers, the organizing committee who's trying to get a union, and the employer who may not want the union. And often this process can be dragged out a lot, and there are a lot of unfair labor practices charges that often come out of it. And frequently we don't end up with a majority vote in favor of the union. Although that's also happened in Milwaukee with Colectivo Coffee, which had a very close vote, but did vote to start a union.
However, some Anodyne workers are skeptical of Fairwave's description of this process as democratic. I asked Vineyard why Fairwave's use of the term democratic process in reference to an NLRB election can be misleading.
Because that tells us that they're going to do whatever it takes to try and get control of the election, the location, and the timing of it. And that, depending on location and time, significantly will then hinder, of the 100% of us who signed union cards, who is available to then go show up and vote. because they can say, look, we've made it democratic because we want to have everyone cast their ballot, never mind the fact that they had to okay the election date and time. They have control.
Yeah. And yeah, so it's not like they're sending out a doodle poll saying, like, when can everyone make it? Nope. It's a, this is going to be at noon on this day. Yeah. There or be square.
Exactly. Like, our union rep had proposed voting across all four locations with various times to factor in the event, if someone happened to be working on election day, there was at least some sort of time slot or location that they could make it to. Fairwave then pushed back and said, nope, Bruce Street, these times.
This NLRB election date is set for May 21st, this Wednesday. If the election results in a majority of votes against the union, then workers can try again after a set period of time. But if workers do vote to unionize, that's just the beginning. The hard part is actually realizing a contract once that union is established. Haywood explains.
If the vote is in favor of the union, then the hard work begins of actually trying to negotiate that first contract. And that is not an easy process. And often it doesn't even happen, in which case you may have won an election, but ultimately you don't have a unionized workplace. This is because the employer opposes the union and tries to do a lot of things to stop that first contract from happening. They use unfair labor practices. They engage in legal loopholes that allow companies to delay or obstruct negotiations. And these make it difficult to reach that first agreement.
This is what happened when workers tried to unionize at Colectivo, another coffee chain with multiple locations in the Milwaukee area. It took nearly 3 years between launching a union drive in 2020 and Colectivo agreeing to a collectively bargained contract in 2023. For more than half that time, Colectivo did not bargain with workers who already had voted to unionize. Instead, it hired lawyers to challenge the results of the union drive by filing appeals with the NLRB. And Fairwave has already hired lawyers in the form of Roe Law Group, a Minnesota-based law firm that was involved in preventing a successful union drive at Spy House Coffee Roasters in Minneapolis, shortly before Spy House joined Fairwave's nationwide network. But a successful union drive is still this week's priority for Vineyard and Anodyne workers. And for now, Vineyard seems propelled by a sense of justice, whatever the future may hold.
None of us know how long we're going to be here. We might as well do something while we can. And also, it was very motivating, too, because it's just like, I would not feel good morally working with a new hire who started at $3 less than what I'm making. I just, no. Like, they deserve to be at the same level.
That piece was produced by Lake Effect Sam Woods at WUWM.com. You can hear the full version, which asks the question, what does it mean to be a local coffee shop? We've got a new season of Bubbler Talk on the way, and we need some new questions. Submit your questions about the Milwaukee area at WUWM.com. Coming up later in the show, we'll learn about the Milwaukee Philatelic Society. But first, Capital Notes looks at the latest with the state budget and what's happening with immigration policy in Wisconsin. That's coming up on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. You're listening to Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers, and here's this week's Capital Notes.
This is Capital Notes from Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Ayan Silver, speaking with J.R. Ross. He's editor of WizPolitics.com. Hi, J.R., thanks for joining me.
Oh, anytime.
All right, so let's start with the state budget for this week. About 54% of the state's Medicaid funding comes from the federal government, but Republican co-chairs of the Joint Finance Committee brushed off concerns about the impact of looming federal cuts. What's the latest on this and on negotiations between GOP leaders and Democratic Governor Tony Evers?
Well, first, we got some new numbers from the Legislative Fiscal Bureau, the nonpartisan budget arm of the legislature. What they're telling us is we're still in decent shape. Remember, the budget's a two-year period. The current one ends June 30th. We're actually going to have a little bit more money than we thought in the state's main checking account when that's over, about $4.3 billion, about $70 million more than we thought before. So in the context of the budget, not a whole lot, but better than having less. Same time, we're going to have less in revenue growth over the next two-year period from 2025 through 2027. That's important because you talk about Medicaid, that's ongoing money. The surplus is one-time fund. So if you take one-time money, spend it for ongoing cost, you create a hole down the road that you got to take care of, either through revenue growth or cuts elsewhere. So what I'm watching for, one, is how they address that. Medicaid, for example, just the cost to continue our current program as is about $1.6 billion in general purpose revenue, which is more money we're going to bring in for new revenue growth the next 2 years. That doesn't leave much to fund schools or, you know, other things, tax cuts, without dipping into your surplus. That surplus, you could do, you know, whatever you want with it. You can pay for ongoing costs, but again, it creates an issue for you to deal with 2 years down the road. Some lawmakers have proposed doing a tax rebate. That's a one-time use of the money. Not sure if that's going to happen. Others want to use it for building projects you can take care of without borrowing costs long term. But there are ideas floating around. What we don't know for sure is what the deal looks like that Devin LeMahieu, Robin Voss, the two leaders of the legislature for Republicans, and Governor Tony Evers want to strike. They met in person March 26. We know that. Since then, staff have been meeting about the budget and taxes and everything else. Both Voss, the Assembly Speaker, and LeMahieu, the Assembly earlier, have been calling for Evers to meet with him directly again, start hammering out a deal. The governor, though, has been saying through his staff, hey, we can have our staffs continue to meet. They'll hammer out these proposals, get to us close to a final deal. When we have a deal in place, I'll come in and sign that thing and we'll knock it out. It looks like Robin and Devin want the governor face-to-face to negotiate. The governor wants the staff to basically take care of those discussions and then sign off on the deal. Who's going to blink? We'll see. But we're getting now to the point where it's mid-May or past mid-May. The fiscal year ends June 30th. Now, there's no repercussion for Wisconsin if we go past June 30th. That's not a big deal. But the longer this goes on, we don't have the answers how we're going to spend our money or do tax cuts for the next 2 years. It's kind of like people are antsy for an answer of what's going on with the state's budget. So kind of watch and see if get this thing rolling sometime soon and get going on it.
So can you explain for a layperson the difference between funding ongoing projects and funding one-time projects and how that plays out with how Wisconsin pays for things? Like, and if you could focus on something like Medicaid, just sort of unpack that.
Well, let's take a tax cut. That's an easy one to do. So one-time money. If I give you a rebate, so let's make it easy. We've got $1 million in a surplus. I'm going to give people $1 million tax rebate. Everybody gets a check. That's a one-time expense, right? You pay for that one-time rebate. That's it. Now, if you reduce tax rates, right, use that $1 million to reduce the rates, well, those rates are going to be reduced not just for that two-year period of the budget that costs you $1 million, but for every 2 years after that as well. That's an ongoing cost. Medicaid, you have ongoing costs because it gets more expensive every year to do Medicaid between prescription drugs and everything else. Those costs go up. Now, the governor, he wants to expand Medicaid to the Affordable Care Act. He's proposed that, I think, all four times Republicans have ripped it out of the budget, saying we don't want to expand welfare. And what the expansion is, right now, Medicaid covers up to 100% of the federal poverty limit in Wisconsin. You can, if you want to as a state, cover people between 100% and 133% through the program. The other option, which Wisconsin has taken, is putting people in that range into the exchanges that are part of the Affordable Care Act. If you expand Medicaid, you get more federal money because you expanded it. That would help take care of those ongoing costs. But because we're not doing that, it requires more state tax dollars to pay for those programs. That's an ongoing cost we have going forward. And look, we're getting older in Wisconsin. including myself, getting closer to retirement age all the time. And so those costs are going to continue to go up as our population grows of those over 65 are eligible for the program.
How is that interacting with what Congress and what President Trump is trying to do with the slicing funding for Medicaid overall in the federal budget?
Well, that's a great question because we're trying to get a straight answer, like what it's going to look like. We know that they want to do things like work requirements, right? That's been put out there. The question is, when would that go into play? So in fact, you would tell people on the program, hey, we're going to make sure that if you can, if you're able-bodied, that you're working to qualify for Medicaid. Okay, well, when might that kick in? How do you do the eligibility checks? How do you check if people are actually working? People would probably lose their coverage from Medicaid if they don't meet certain qualifications. That's a big question, how that's going to happen. They've talked about reducing the key word, the catchphrase for Republicans is fraud, waste, and abuse, right? But that's in the eye of the beholder. Other folks who say the people who are on the program, they should be there. But they haven't really been able to knock out that bill yet in the House. So we know exactly what it's going to look like. And they have to negotiate with the U.S. Senate, see what they want to do. And oh, by the way, I hate to bring politics up, but it affects everything. Medicaid reductions aren't real popular right now. If you look at the polls. So there are a lot of Republicans who are in swing seats saying, that might not be great for me next fall when I go face the voters. I'm not sure I want to question that debate.
Interesting. Okay. Well, something else that was happening last week was the Senate Committee on Licensing, Regulatory Reform, State and Federal Affairs. It held a public hearing on a GOP bill that's aiming to enlist county sheriffs to aid ICE. Now, immigration is all over the news. It's a big key component of the Trump administration's efforts. They're doing a crackdown. Local Republicans are trying to respond to that. What's important to know there?
The bill already passed the Assembly. So we know Republicans are behind it. It'll probably pass the Senate, but it's going to be a party line vote again. And so it looks like the governor, if I had to bet, will probably veto that one. He hasn't seemed real thrilled about it so far. So it's a lot of messaging right now about immigration. Now, one of the questions is, how is that going to play next fall? Now, Evers, that said, he's going to seek a third term. But Republicans have looked at his numbers in the polls, and he's consistently been around 50%, you know, give or take a few points here or there. They want to paint him as out of touch with Wisconsinites in general. And if you look at the polls, the public in general supports efforts to take people who are undocumented and remove them from the country. They like the idea of law enforcement cooperating with federal immigration officials. So can Republicans message that in a way to paint the governor as out of touch and extreme, quote unquote, compared with the average Wisconsinite on that issue? And the other thing is, will that issue resonate next fall in the elections, even if they are successful in painting the governors out of touch with the average Wisconsin on that issue?
Where are you getting the information that people are on board?
Polling that people, now, it depends how you ask the question, right? So if you ask about like removing somebody who's here who has a criminal offense, that's pretty much broad support. Somebody who's been here for years and has a job and is, you know, being productive, if you want to use that word, that's a much different question to ask. But generally speaking, if you're talking people who are here who have are undocumented, have criminal offenses, there's broad support in the polls that I've seen for those policies from the Trump administration to remove those folks. Now, again, getting depends where you go with that question, right? The case of the guy out in Maryland who was moved to a prison in Central America, that's a whole different ball of wax, right? I'm talking general broad strokes about where the polling is at when it comes to immigration enforcement in this country.
And what is this bill specifically asking for? It's asking to do differently. So right now, ICE can issue an administrative warrant and people can be booked into the jail and the sheriff's department doesn't have to ask them what their immigration status is or to let ICE know if they happen to be undocumented, right?
Yeah, and it has also a hammer there, a penalty that if you don't cooperate, you lose 15% of, I believe it's 15% of your shared revenue, which is state aid to local governments. That is like the stick they want to use to try and compel enforcement or compliance. I think it's like Dane County, Milwaukee County, maybe a couple others that aren't quote unquote in compliance right now. And that would be a punishment for them. They lose money. That's another concern Evers has raised about having that in there.
I see. Okay. So last week, the state Supreme Court set up a timeline for arguments on two petitions for original action on congressional redistricting. What can you tell us about that? Why? What's the difference between those two petitions?
So you need a history lesson. Go back to 2011. Republicans had control of the legislature and the governor's office and passed bills that had new maps for the legislature and for the congressional districts. Fast forward to 2021. Democrat Governor Tony Evers, Republican lawmakers can't agree on maps. The state Supreme Court says when you submit maps to us, you have to take the least change approach to what was done in 2011. Ultimately, the court picked Evers' congressional map and the legislature's legislative lines. 2023, now you have a liberal majority. That court takes up a challenge to the legislative maps and says there's a constitutional issue with those maps. Along with that, we don't believe the least change approach works. It's not a good foundation for a map. 2024, Mark Elias, who's a big Dem attorney, files a request to the Supreme Court. Hey, you should redraw those congressional lines. If least change isn't good for legislative maps, it's not good for congressional ones. Court says no. So now we have these two petitions filed with the court, asking the justice to take the case directly. It's called a petition for original action without making it go to the lower courts. They have one thing in common. They both argue that least change, if it's not a good policy for the legislative maps, then you can't have congressionalists based on least change. Well, problem number one is the court already unanimously rejected taking a case on that premise. Now, can the court change its mind? Absolutely, you can. So let's keep that in mind. Number two, one of the lawsuits argues that the districts are malapportioned. If you take Wisconsin's population divided among eight districts, at least back when the maps are drawn, you could have districts with only just a difference of one person in the population in each district. Right now, we have a couple that have a difference of two people. I'm not an attorney, I always say. I've talked to some, and it's a high bar to get a court throughout the maps based on that you're off by two people, not one. But, you know, it's an interesting question of how much can you have a deviation of population in a district. That lawsuit also argues that there are too many counties that are split as the districts are formed. So it's not the entire county in one district. Now, one lawsuit is filed by Elias again. He's back. It argues that the maps are a partisan gerrymander. I think a quintessential partisan gerrymander, he wrote in the brief. Basically saying you've got a map that right now have six Republican seats, two Democratic ones, was drawn for a partisan purpose. Now, there's a problem with that. One, I'm not going to argue about whether you can have a partisan gerrymander or not. But the reason that map was drawn was not to be a partisan gerrymander. It was drawn to make the incumbents happy. You have to go back to 2011. When that map was drawn, there was a lawsuit, and it challenged the map. In that lawsuit, the chief of staff for Paul Ryan gave a deposition. He testified about drawing that map. It wasn't lawmakers in the Capitol who drew it. It was basically the delegation consulting each other. This guy said that he went around at the direction of Paul Ryan, asked members what they wanted in the map to address their concerns. Now, Sean Duffy, who was a brand new lawmaker in the 7th District, North Wisconsin, he wanted to, quote, shore up his district because he won a seat that had been in Democratic hands for 40 years, basically. The rest of them, though, they wanted things like Tammy Baldwin and Tom Petri, both in the delegation, wanted to make sure their districts weren't too big. They didn't want to drive too far to go see their constituents. They wanted it to be easier to go see people and meet with their constituents. Reed Ribble, who was the member for the Green Bay Area 8th District, he said, hey, got to make my seat bigger. I wouldn't mind having Calumet County because I got property down there. So it wasn't really a partisan intent in drawing the map. If you're going to argue it's a partisan gerrymander, you kind of might have to prove intent. That's not the intent that we saw, at least from that deposition. Now, again, lawyers can make other arguments, but if that's your foundation, you're going to have a hard time proving intent based off that deposition from more than a decade ago.
Boiling it down very briefly, though, the difference between the two petitions, what would it be?
One argues partisan gerrymander. One argues malapportionment. They both argue least intent's no good. You throw the maps out.
Gotcha. Okay. And so your assessment stands as far as when we talked from Capitol Notes a few weeks ago that it's kind of an uphill battle for Democrats.
Yeah, it looks like it. Now, again, you know, justices change their minds. Lawyers make good, interesting arguments. So we'll see. All the court has done right now is said, hey, you guys have the opportunity to persuade us if we should take this case. They've not taken it yet. They've not agreed to go to the merits. All they said is, we will hear your arguments if we should take this case. So Elections Commission, you've got until May 29th to tell us what you think. Everybody else, you got until May 30th. Then we'll go from there.
And because the court is liberal controlled, you don't think it's an automatic for Democrats to be able to get in, especially because in 2024, the court rejected a petition, right?
Yeah. So they've done it before. Again, Justice can change their minds. That is totally allowed. But they've already said no one time. And oh, by the way, this other thing I've been told to watch for is, if the court, Supreme Court of Wisconsin, were to take this case, if it were to try and draw a new map, you would maybe get the attention of the U.S. Supreme Court. Then they might step in and say, hey, you guys can't do this, or we're taking it over, or whatnot. So the chance of having a map in 2026 that's new, not great. I mean, they could be successful, but in talking to lawyers who specialize in this area, they're skeptical that you'll see a new map in 2026 for Wisconsin.
Well, thanks as always for this background, JR, and thanks for joining me on Capitol Notes.
Anytime. Have a great day.
That was J.R. Ross, editor of WisPolitics, speaking with WUWM's Mayan Silver. You can hear Capitol Notes every other Monday on Lake Effect. And just like Capitol Notes, Lake Effect is also a podcast. Search for Lake Effect wherever you get your podcasts to download and listen on demand. Coming up next, we'll learn about the Milwaukee Philatelic Society and break some stereotypes about this seemingly humdrum hobby.
Stamp collectors, you know, you think of as being, you know, these sedate people who, you know, sit in their dens and work on their collections. But there still can be some pretty dramatic disagreements.
That's coming up on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. This is Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. Did you know that Milwaukee is home to one of the oldest stamp clubs in the country? The Milwaukee Philatelic Society is nearly 130 years old, and its club members meet regularly each month. Collectors say stamps are art and history in miniature form, and it's an inexpensive hobby to get into. Lake Effect's Excret Nunez sits down with Rob Hennick, the historian for the Milwaukee Philatelic Society, and Blaine Kirsch, the president of the Stamp Club. Hennick begins by explaining how the club got started.
Well, in the 1800s, people mostly thought of stamp collecting as something the kids did. There was not really an organized nationwide stamp collecting group until 1886, I think it was, the American Philatelic Association started. Milwaukee wasn't long after that. In November of 1899, a group of six men, because mostly it was men collecting at the time, met in downtown Milwaukee, and they formed the Milwaukee Philatelic Society. And it's been going ever since then.
That's so neat. And so can you tell me about what meetings were like when the club first started?
Unfortunately, at some point in the history of the club, the secretary who had all of the archives passed away, and whoever was dealing with their possessions, they don't exist anymore. Mm. So I've had to piece together a lot of the history of the club, and we don't actually have the minutes for these early meetings. But generally, from what I can find, it looks like they had discussions. They shared their stamp albums, what things they were interested in, what they were collecting. I do have one early controversy that made it into one of those stamp newspapers, which was there was a big debate at the time about whether you should collect the entire envelope that had the stamp on it and all the markings showing how it was transported in the mail and where it started, where it ended up, whether you should collect those as a whole or whether you should just cut off the stamp, soak off the stamp, and just collect the stamp. And this was a big debate at the time. Today, people who are collectors may like to collect just the stamps as opposed to what we call postal history, but they don't really indicate or don't really believe that one or the other is illegitimate. Apparently at the time, this is back in 1904, where this big debate in the Milwaukee Philatelic Society happened. They were at each other's throats.
Oh, my God.
you know, stamp collectors, you know, you think of as being, you know, these sedate people who, you know, sit in their dens and work on their collections. But there still can be some pretty dramatic disagreements in the group.
And Blaine, what does the club do today? What are meetings like and what do you guys do?
Well, fortunately, we're not at each other's throats when we're at the meeting. We meet at the Brookfield Library, typically the second Tuesday of the month. A big part of the club, our club, is not only the business meeting that we do have like a program for the evening. We did have somebody that was visiting a family from India that came in and talked about the principality issued revenues. So we'll have different speakers each month.
And how many active members would you say the Milwaukee Philatelic Society currently has?
Good question. We have about, I think there's 108 right now, basically across the United States. You know, vast majority, 90% of them are probably within 50 miles of Milwaukee. At our regular meetings, we have about 20 to 25 people. And we have two major auctions in the year at the Stamp Club at our regular meetings. And last month, we had 40 people there bidding on stamps.
That's really interesting. And I think a lot of listeners would find that really interesting, too. I don't know if a lot of people know about the strong stamp club and collectors that we have here in the Milwaukee area.
Well, historically, it's been very strong in Milwaukee. As of 1908, which is only like 10 years after the club was founded, there were 55 members of the National Club here in Milwaukee, which was more than any other city in the country other than New York and Chicago. And in, I think it was 1900, we actually had the National Convention of the National Organization here. If you remember hearing about Mayor Rose, he liked to bring conventions to Milwaukee.
But why is it Milwaukee specifically that has such a strong national like hold or attention with the stamp collectors?
At the time, it was hypothesized that it was the German population, that the German culture was kind of drawn to collecting. You could actually get involved in stamp collecting for no money at all. You get mail coming in every day. You cut off the stamps, you soak them off, and you have a collection. Same thing today that still, I think, attracts some kids to it is the idea that you can collect these very artistic little pieces of paper for either no money at all, getting it off the mail if you actually get mail coming in, or by having friends and family saving them for you. That's a way to learn about different places. You naturally want to learn what the stamp is about, or at least some people do.
Right. I can just hear that there's so many different avenues and so many different reasons why people get interested in collecting stamps. I love stationery. So I have a lot of friends who live all over the country. So we send each other postcards a lot. All that to say, I'm curious, when did you first start collecting stamps and what is it that keeps you interested in collecting?
I was more of a coin collector. And when we moved back to Milwaukee in 1987, I went to the coin club meetings. Then we had our second daughter, and there was a stamp club that was a lot closer than the coin club. So I could go to the stamp club and get back in time for putting the kids to bed. And so I started going to the stamp club meetings, and then my focus turned to that rather than coin collecting. And then it just kind of blew up, as my wife would say. So my main interest now is exhibiting on a national level. My first exhibit was on state marijuana tax stamps. That's because one of my cases, actually one of my wife's cases, she's also a lawyer, involved the Wisconsin marijuana stamps. So I started collecting those. I also collect potatoes on junk mail from early 1900s. And I have an exhibit of non-equine horses, which is basically things that are named horse something, but are not actually horses. Things like horseshoes or horse geraniums or horse cave. It's just kind of a fun side thing, not real serious.
Yeah. What about you, Blaine? When did you first start collecting stamps, and what is it that keeps you interested?
Earlier in my career, consulting engineering, we were working a lot of hours, and my wife said to get a hobby. So for like 94 to 96, we lived up in Green Bay and started collecting used stamps. Then we had kids and put the stamp collection down for 18 years or so. And there was a big national show in Milwaukee in 2013, found out about MPS and that, and started going to their meetings. So what do I collect? I collect Mint U.S., Mint Canada, and the Micronations of Europe. And then I got like an ice theme, Antarctic territories. But my what I'm collecting now is hand-painted first day covers. So typically there's a hand-painted image about the stamp on there. And I like the artwork that's on those. That's kind of what I'm collecting right now, first day covers.
We talked a lot about the history of the club. What do you think has kept the Milwaukee Philatelic Society alive and running for so many years?
People who just want to get together and share time with others who share their passion. And it's something that you can keep doing for your entire life. You can start as a kid. You can go away from it for a while. And it's something that you can come back when you have more free time. It's something that you can come back to that kind of ties you to something you did and you loved when you were young. It's something that just kind of connects your whole life together.
Blaine, I would like to ask you, what do you think needs to be done to keep this club going for 126 more years?
Bringing in younger members. We have a wide age range. I would say we have new members that are within the last 6 months, and we have some members that have 50 years with the club. And trying to get the kids involved, we have an outreach at our shows. You know, we have kids can go and get free stamps, and trading and selling of stamps. As people come and go, some people are downsizing their stamp collection, and club members get to buy those at the different auctions. So it's just an interest and getting people involved at a younger age. Or empty nesters, their children move on and you need something to fill the time. That's kind of where I am now.
And before we wrap up, I like to reflect on what we've talked about and ask you, why would you encourage someone to start collecting stamps?
Because I think they would find enjoyment. I found a lot of enjoyment in collecting stamps and teaching about stamps and exhibiting and judging over the last 35 years that I've been involved. And there's, again, there's something for everybody. It's a way to learn. It's a way to keep your mind active. And it's a way to meet some really great people. And you can do it without spending a lot of money.
Yeah.
One thing I would not suggest to people is that you start collecting stamps as an investment. That is the silliest thing to do. With stamp collecting, you get the enjoyment, the satisfaction of filling a page in your album, or you know, seeing the faces of someone as you're discussing your particular interest. That's where the value comes in.
Well, Blaine and Rob, thank you so much for speaking with me today. I really enjoyed learning more about the Stamp Club and stamp collecting.
Well, you're very welcome. Thank you.
Rob Hennick is the historian, and Blaine Kirsch is the president of the Milwaukee Philatelic Society. They both spoke with Lake Effect's Excret Nunez. To learn more about the historic Stamp Club, visit WUWM.com. And that wraps up today's show. Thank you so much for being here with us. I'm Joy Powers. If you missed any of Lake Effect this week, you can find all of our conversations at WUWM.com. If you'd like to take the show on the go, you can download the Lake Effect podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Could singing actually improve your heart health? Join us again tomorrow at noon to find out. Thanks so much for joining us right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.